Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Tim Smith and Matthew McCulloch from Tanundra Winery in Barossa. How are you boys?
Very well, thanks.
Good, Chris. Yourself?
Yep, very good indeed. Just a quick overview of who you are. Matt, what do you do at McCulloch? Can I call you Matt?
Yeah, cool, Matt. Yeah, no problem. I'm the general manager of Chateau Tanundra, so I try and keep everybody under control at the chateau.
And I'm the winemaker at Chateau Tanundra. I'm responsible for all our Chateau Tanundra and various other brand wines that we make at Chateau Tanundra.
Fantastic. Now, the reason we got you on the show, or part of the reason, is Matt approached me and said, look, we've won some big awards. Do you want to tell us what the awards were and which competitions they were for, Matt?
Yeah, at the International Wine and Spirit Competition, we were lucky enough to pick up the world's best Shiraz stroke Syrah trophy. So 450 wines were selected for that from around the world, down to a short list of 13, of which we had two. And our Everest Shiraz 2005 picked up the world's best Shiraz stroke Syrah. And the other one, which is probably more exciting for us, was the Everest Grenache from 2008, which picked up the single estate trophy for the red wine.
So you're over here to collect your awards. You're in the UK at the moment. We're actually recording in my loft, my brand new loft. What do you think of it, Matt? Because you've heard all the news about the things.
It's fantastic. I can't believe I'm actually standing in the loft of which I've heard so much about.
Yeah, anyway, let's crack on with this. All right, so you've come over to collect your awards. The award ceremony's tomorrow night. That's right. Are you after any other awards, or are you quite happy with the two you've got?
We'll take whatever we can get, to be honest. But no, it looks like we're going to pick up the one for the Shiraz, and there's a couple of others yet to be decided on the night.
And how does it work? You've got the trophy, Shiraz and the world's best wine. Does that mean that you're eligible for other entries because of that, or?
That puts us in for Australian producer of the show. So there's six on the short list, four of which are from the Barossa. So there's Yolumba, St. Hallett and Peter Lehman, plus a Chateau, so four out of the six for the Barossa. I think we're in a good chance. And then there's also Stella Bella from WA and Morris Wines, the fortified wines. So if we're lucky enough to get Australian producer, you're then into winemaker of the show. But as Tim said, we've got two, so we're more than happy with that. If we get any more, that's just a bonus.
At the end of the show, I will announce what the results were, because this will be going out after you've won or not won. So we'll know what the story is. Mm. So I'll let people know at the end of the interview what's going on. But let's talk a wee bit about those wines and Tanundra as well, because the winery is old, but it's actually quite young as well. Do you want to just give us a quick overview of that, and then we'll talk about the wines and the regions a bit more?
Yeah, sure. Well, Chateau Tanundra was built in 1890, and at its time that it was built, it was the largest building in the Southern Hemisphere devoted exclusively to wine. So it is a building of some significance. Originally built to process the grapes of near enough to 500 grape growers in the Barossa Valley.
Was it like a co-op?
It was like a co-op, yeah. Ironically, in a time of drought, so it just goes to show that everything old is new again these days. And it was owned by various people over the years, closed down last vintage as a functioning winery in 1995 when the owner, Mr. John Geber, bought the property in 1998, rebuilt it, and we started producing wines again in a newly built winery.
Why did it shut down in the first place?
The site was actually owned by some larger wineries, and they were just sort of streamlining their operations, and they started making their wines more centralised at fewer wineries. So that's the only reason it was closed down, become superfluous to needs when it was owned by Southcorp. But John refurbished the winery and installed a basket press in 2005. It was the first new fashioned basket press that was arrived in the country, and we've been making wines since the vintage 2005.
Okay. And at one point it was a distillery as well, so the buildings had quite a marked or checkered history.
Yeah, and that's, I guess it's a bit of a burden we carry with the Chateau Tanundra brand, is the fact that in Australia, at least anyway, most people tend to associate Chateau Tanundra with either brandy or fortifieds. And everybody's got a war story about Chateau Tanundra brandy. My mum claims she's had a bottle in the wardrobe, for medicinal purposes. But it really is, ironically, it's a 120-year-old building with a fairly new brand, new modern wine styles. And, we're not about brandy or fortified wines these days.
It looks like, a lot of Australians do things like, they do wine tourism and all that sort of stuff very well. But you guys seem to have really gone a bit crazy on it with the building.
Well, look, one of the things, John has amazing vision, and when he saw the chateau, he saw a home for his brand in Barossa, which he saw as the home of the most famous wine region in Australia. But what he saw also was the potential for tourism. It's all well and good having this lovely historic building, but you want to get people to come to it. So he spent a lot of money on refurbishing the cellar door. We've put in a competition standard croquet lawn. We also have the CCG, which is the shadow cricket ground.
How do you feel about croquet, Tim? Just a winemaker, you know, croquet?
Not- as a croquet player, I'm a really good winemaker.
Yeah, he handles his mallet very well. We've got a cricket oval in there as well. We have a charity match every 2 years in aid of the David Hooks Foundation, who was a cricketer who tragically died, but was a big believer in organ donation. And at some point in the future, there are plans for accommodation on the property, but that's a way down the track. John also owns the Barossa Wine Train, which is a 1950s diesel-electric beauty. And the idea is that we're going to have trains running from the centre of Adelaide out to the chateau, as we have our own station, as you do. And the station was gifted to the town about 90 years ago. But again, it's all about this vision. Is that, yes, look, we always thought we made great wines. Unfortunately, someone's now confirmed that, which was nice. But we're just trying to give as much, I suppose, entertainment as you like to people coming to the valley. Have an experience. Not everyone is a wine drinker, strangely enough. So when they come to the Barossa, if they can play cricket or croquet, or they can go and see an art gallery or do something else. So for those non-wine loving people, there is actually something to do there. But first and foremost, we are a world-class winery that happens to have a bit of entertainment tagged on the side.
Okay, so you see yourselves primarily as a winery. How much wine do you produce each year, volume-wise?
Look, the chateau, we crush about 800 to 900 tons, so that would work out to be about 60,000 cases a year from the Barossa.
But that's sort of large, small producer.
Yeah, a large, small producer. That's a pretty good way of putting it. Tim can tell you more about how the wines are made at the chateau, but it's very hands-on. And whilst 60,000 cases sounds a lot, it all goes through Tim's hands and his team. So we're in control of everything that's happening there. But I think in the scheme of things, it's compared to, I know, Penfolds or Wolf Blass or some of the really big guys, we are just very small.
Yeah.
And do you own all the land that you use? Do all the grapes come from your own vineyards, or what sort of vineyard space do you have at Tanundra?
Okay, so I guess in terms of actual tons that comes through the winery, roughly half is estate-grown fruit. The other half is contract growers. And the interesting thing is that we have grower suppliers that have actually supplied Chateau Tanundra since 1890, since the winery was built. So there's a handful of families, the Leishes, they've actually been supplying grapes ever since the Chateau was actually built.
Let's talk a wee bit about where you get the wine grapes from.
Yep.
And where Tanundra is in the big Barossa, because Barossa is now getting carved up into smaller sub-regions. It's no longer Barossa, Eden Vale. And do you get your fruit from the same place in Barossa or scattered around? Or what's the story
there? Well, it's interesting. That is a good point about the different sub-regions within the Barossa. We tend to source all of our fruit from pretty well every single little sub-region within the Barossa Valley. And, we make those wines, keep those wines as discrete individual parcels. Yeah, I think it's been described as a winemaker's paradise and an accountant's nightmare, just trying to keep, tabs on exactly what's where. But and we tend to blend all those wines into our own, what I call a house style of Shiraz. But we also have been quite active. In fact, probably we're the first producer in the Barossa Valley to bottle off individual vineyard parcels to actually highlight the very different regions of the Barossa Valley, Ebenezer, Lindock, Greenock, and that sort of thing. And, going forward, there'll be an Eden Valley Shiraz as well. So, yeah, we source fruit from all over the Barossa, simply because some in every vintage is different, and every vintage brings different strengths and weaknesses with each individual region.
We were talking earlier about sort of your pyramid of wines. You know, most wineries have the base pyramid, which is the cheapest wines that have the highest volume and, is the bread and butter. But then you have these pinnacle wines that give brand, awareness, and people sort of hear it, which I've tried your two award-winning wines, and I must admit that Grenache is Very, very good.
And did the judges get it right?
Well, the Grenache they did. I'm not so sure about the Shiraz, but the Grenache is definitely a top wine, no doubt about it. But judges, you get a range of good wines in front of you, and it's like, which one wins? You mentioned that your top wines, when we were talking earlier, were single varietal, but not necessarily single vineyard. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Does that mean you're not a terroirist?
I think it means that absolutely we are terroirist, but we tend to look for fundamentally varietal definition in our wines. So Grenache needs to look like Grenache. It doesn't need to look like some sort of tricked up version of Grenache, unless we stay. Otherwise, if it's a blend, then yes, unashamedly we put a hand up and say this is a blend of, you know, Grenache, Shiraz, Mourvèdre, whatever the case may be. But fundamentally at the top end, our varietal wines are exactly that. And but they are not necessarily single vineyard unless we state so.
Okay, and what does that mean in terms of the style of wine you're trying to create? Because if the wine comes from a hot region, then obviously you're trying to create a style that's maybe a wee bit more alcoholic, but riper fruit, cool region, maybe slightly the opposite direction. But when you're getting stuff from all over the vineyard, then the winemaker's style becomes more important than the regional style. So is it, how do you pick what style you're going to create for your top wines each year?
Good question, and that's true. Inevitably, wouldn't matter which winemaker made the wine, there would certainly be the winemaker's stamp or thumbprint on those wines. It's just inevitable. But I guess from a house style point of view, I guess with a European heritage there that our proprietor brings to the winery, we would be looking at probably ripe fruit, but some sort of savoury European edges. And you've mentioned before, you know, higher alcohols. It's not something we actively seek. I think if you're making wine in a warm region, by default, you need to accept that there will be higher alcohol because, quite frankly, Shiraz and Abrosa Valley doesn't ripe until it's 14 Beaumet, whereas in Cote Rôti, it may well be fully ripe at 12 Beaumet. It's just, you know, a function of the region.
Yeah, you're talking phenolic ripeness versus sugar alcohol.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, they are linked. And for me, from a personal point of view, I really like ripe, overt fruit characters in red wines. It's the very thing, ironically, that the old world tend to chase and probably don't quite capture every single year, whereas in Abrosa, we are fortunate we can do that. And, you know, I guess if my personal stamp is put on the wines, then, yeah, it's fully ripe fruit with fully ripe phenolics and opulent fruit weight.
We mentioned earlier that you use inoculated yeast to make the wines. Do you use yeast that are particularly inefficient, for example, maybe to keep that alcohol levels a bit lower? Some yeast are quite efficient at converting sugar to alcohol, some are less efficient. Does that become a thing that you look for in your yeast strain selection, or is it...
That's a really good question as well. There's no conscious effort to look at that. I think if anything we're looking at with yeast and bacteria selection, we're looking at using less cultured yeast. It would be nice if the natural indigenous yeast were low converters. I find that you get actually a lower sugar conversion to alcohol. It's more vintage specific than it is yeast specific. For argument's sake, in 2007, we're picking fruit at 14.5% Beaumet, which theoretically gives you a 15% alcohol wine, and yet we haven't got a wine in the winery higher than 14.2% alcohol. So it was actually a vintage condition and sugar composition of the fruit that brings about the lower conversion rate.
What's driving that? Is it nitrogen levels or yan or...
If I knew, I'd be writing a book and I'd be rich and retired. And I could actually sound intelligent and say, yes, you're dead right, but I really don't know. 2008 was the opposite. We had fruit being picked at 14 Beaumet, but high alcohol levels. So short answer is I don't know. Yes, ideally we would be spinning off less alcohol converted to the sugar conversion, but ultimately, I guess, if you look at what we're working towards, it's my wish that we can actually move towards not using any cultured yeast whatsoever. But the reality is we are a fully functional winery and we need to turn over fruit relatively quickly, so we can't afford to have fruit sitting there for 3 weeks at a time.
While
it's trying to do its own thing. Yeah, if it was my winery, yes, we'd probably, we wouldn't be using any cultured yeast. We do use uninoculated bacteria, which is probably a more interesting concept, I think, than yeast, because...
That's for the malolactic fermentation.
A lot of wineries struggle to get 14.5%, 15% alcohol wines through malolactic because the alcohol's too high. At Chateau, we have no problem getting our wines through Mallow. And if you think about the history of the building, it's got a history of fortified production. It's got a history of brandy, and any bacteria that can live in 20% alcohol is really strong. And it's also my belief that a lot of the stamp that comes on the Chateau Tanunda wines is due to that bacteria. It's rampant. We had a year when I took over as a winemaker, and I thought I was going to change the world and brought in all these cultured Mallow bacteria, and they didn't work. And everything I didn't touch raced through. So I think there's a lesson there.
You described earlier when we were talking before the show that you're into lazy winemaking. Does that mean you've got a big sofa in the winery, you know, just sitting there smoking a pipe, you know, drinking some beers and sort of saying, oh, it'll sort itself out?
Oh, we do drink a lot of beer. Yeah, it's true. Theoretically, if you think about the winemaking process, I mean, I've alluded to the fact of using or relying to a certain extent on cultured yeast and malolactic bacteria. Other than your oak inputs, which we're relatively low on new oak input with our wines. Theoretically, it's my belief that if you get the fruit right in the vineyard, the whole winemaking process really is a degradation process. It's yeast converting sugar to alcohol and bacteria converting malic acid into lactic acid. It's a degradation process. So therefore, the single biggest decision a winemaker can make each year is picking time and getting to the fruit getting the fruit to the winery in a timely manner. From there on, its degradation process. All you have to do is monitor the rate that happens or doesn't happen. And ironically, it actually comes about by doing not too great smoke and mirrors in the winery.
You mentioned picking time. Do you pick on sugar levels or on flavour levels or tannins? What? How do you decide on picking time?
I would be the laziest winemaker in the world. I simply go into a vineyard and I spend more time walking up and down vineyard rows during vintage than I do anything else. You just ask the accountants to ask for all the numbers from me about movements. I don't worry about anything like that during vintage because it's the only window that you get to get a wine right. And, I take rough sugar measurements in the vineyard with a refractometer, but fundamentally I pick on flavour ripeness because, you know, you can do a lot of things in the winery. You can add acid, you can add sugar, which we don't. You can add yeast. You can do all those sorts of things to compensate for any shortcomings in the wines. But one thing that science hasn't given us is fruit flavour. You don't just buy a tin of fruit flavour and add it to the wine.
What do you taste when you're tasting a Grenache or a Shiraz? Because some people say that, you know, you've got precursors in the grapes, but not necessarily the final flavour compounds that form during the fermentation process. Yep. So what are you looking for in the grapes when you're tasting them?
Yeah, I guess, you know, the age-old question about winemaking being art and a science, I guess that's where the art comes into it, where you need to sort of think probably 4 or 5 days ahead, because if I make a decision to pick grapes today, it's not going to happen for 4 or 5 days realistically. So you need to factor into your mind the fudge factor, how long it's going to evolve. One eye on the weather, one eye on your winery, depending on how much space you can get in. What I look for with Shiraz, I look for fully ripe seed tannins.
So the seeds are sort of that browny colour.
Seeds need to be brown. Obviously, all grapes have got white flesh, but with Shiraz, in my opinion, and Mataro as well, just before it hits what I call the sweet spot, the flesh does tend to colour up quite a bit. You look for that. Also, the tannin ripeness, one of the things that I find is a really good precursor is the colour of the stems on the grapes. They need to start lignifying, and it's one of the great secrets in Burgundy that when you get lignified stems like that...
What's lignified?
The ripening of grapes is actually a degradation process as well. And as a grapevine starts to shut down, the stems start to go brown from that bright, lucid green that you get.
Yep.
And that's an indication that the close of the season for that variety is on its way, and so they start to brown off. And so therefore, you've got escalating sugar levels, you've got decreasing acid levels, and you've also got lignifying of the stems, which to me is a sign as well of full ripeness. And when we make the Grenache, I do include some stems in the ferment, and you only do that in years where you've got full lignification of the stems. Otherwise, you get green, harsh, phenolic characters.
And the last question is, at the very beginning you mentioned that you've got a basket press,
yep,
which is a wee bit different to maybe some of the very sophisticated bladders and steel cylinders that people use to press. Mm. Why have you gone for a basket press?
Good question. If you're building a winery today based on productivity, it'll be the last thing you'd actually put in because it's so slow. And yeah, you're right. If you're building a winery today based on high throughput, you would have a bladder press or a tank press or even a membrane press a screw press because they've got great extraction rates. Basket press gives you all the things you don't want to look for in a productive winery. They're slow, the extract is low, and they're labour intensive. But the trade-off is you get low phenolic extraction in the wines, which is what I'm looking for. You do get low extracts, which is fine because the tail end of pressing any grape, whether it's red or white, is always quite phenolic anyway, and they're not the characters we're looking for, especially in our red wines. So, yeah, fundamentally, it's a quality decision. And it's ironic that you look at any old winemaking book and there's a picture of a guy, you know, cranking on an old basket press. The one we have isn't, you know, manually operated. It's automatic. It's hydraulically operated. Yeah. So it's a combination of old and new world technology.
Do you not find that basket press is quite oxidative? You know, a lot of the cylinders and that, you know, you can flush them with sulfur dioxide gas beforehand, or carbon dioxide gas beforehand, and protect the fruit from oxidation. And, you know, in Australia, the reductive winemaking, particularly 20 years ago, was king, really, wasn't it? It was like keep the fruit as fruity as possible by keeping the oxygen away, and basket press sort of does introduce a lot of oxygen into that. Do you think that's a material part in your choice?
I think it's absolutely critical because the whole fermentation process relies on oxygen uptake for healthy yeast cultures, whether they're inoculated or uninoculated. The other thing is, as well, with red wines, you need oxygen uptake to stabilise the colour. So, you know, all the things they taught you at winemaking school 20, 30 years ago, throw them out the window. It's not the case. I actually actively seek a lot of oxygen during fermentation and pressing as well.
Okay. I think we'll wrap it up there, Matt and Tim. Thank you very much for your time.
No worries. Thank you.
Cheers.
Pleasure.